And, counsel, tell us where we left off on this thing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2611, we received the engrossed form of that. We had a public hearing on April 30th. You may or may not recall that this is the bill that sets out civil rules for juvenile court in dependency cases. And when I say dependency, that includes dependency and determination of parental rights cases. This bill is before you for several reasons. Probably the paramount reason is that the courts have been wrestling and deciding what rules apply to juvenile cases. And there have been some decisions that said from the court maybe they should just apply the civil rules of procedure, which I think most scholars and practitioners in this area have thought that that would be a very bad idea because you're dealing with a child's life and it has different time frames to deal with. So this bill we left off, I think it was a bit of it's a large bill. It's a bill that's very technical. One of the questions I think Senator Minnis, Mr. Chairman, you brought up was, is it a constitutional right to have an attorney in these dependency cases? And I think without a doubt the answer is yes, and it's I think that was the main question that was on your mind, Mr. Chairman. If there are continued questions, we've got lots of people who could answer them here. Michael Livingston's here, Kathy Osborne's here, David Kanagi is here. They all, I'm sorry, Ann Christian is here, although she's obscured from my view. Now she's not. They'd all be able to answer.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2611, A engrossed to the Senate floor, do pass recommendation. Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2611, A engrossed to the floor of the Senate, do pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? No objections?
It is done. And Senator Brown, who participated in this bill, will be assigned a carrier.
Can I go talk to the union?
All right. Public hearing, House Bill 2600, the false urine bill. Anybody here signed up?
Maybe they need more time.
Okay. Well, we'll
need to see the Senate for 3446. Also need the public hearing.
All right. We'll wait for Representative Patridge or some of us
to
come here, and we will move to public hearing on House Bill 3446. Department of Corrections, OHSU, pilot program. Anybody here on that bill?
3446?
3446.
Mm-hmm. House Bill 3446. Somebody's raising their hand. Somebody's raising their hand. Yep.
Sir, if you'll identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. My name is Gary Field. I'm the Administrator of Counseling and Treatment Services for the State Department of Corrections. I'm here today to provide information in support of House Bill 3446-A. Because of fiscal constraints and previous concerns about program effectiveness, the Department of Corrections does not currently provide sex offender treatment to inmates. The proposed study group would review the recent research and newer program models to reconsider the priority of sex offender treatment to inmates. Because our written testimony is so brief, with your permission, I'll add a few additional background comments. In reviewing all correctional programs, the department currently applies two acid tests. One, is the program legally mandated? For example, we would argue that mental health treatment, basic mental health treatment for inmates is legally mandated. Sex offender treatment does not have a legal mandate. Second, if not legally mandated, is there clear and convincing evidence of its effectiveness? We would argue, for example, that with alcohol and drug treatment, there is that clear and convincing evidence in the research of its effectiveness. The same cannot, however,
What did you just say?
that there is clear and convincing evidence of the effectiveness of alcohol and drug treatment on reducing criminal recidivism.
On alcohol and drug?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
However, we don't think the same argument can be made with regard to sex offender treatment. I am not saying here that sex offender treatment is not effective. What we're saying is that the available research presents less than clear and convincing evidence currently. In the research literature, the most hopeful approach is close community supervision with concurrent community treatment after release. Previous decisions have been to put our money there rather than into institution treatment. We recognize that there are differing points of view on this. However, the research on institution-based sex offender treatment is improving, and re-examination of this position is reasonable. The department has been doing this on an ongoing basis. If it is the will of the legislature that we do so more formally and report back, we are there. In fact, much of this work has already been done, so that this bill represents little additional workload for the department. Thank you.
Give me a little bit of background for maybe some supporting information, how this is going to be coordinated with the Oregon University system, for instance.
Chair Menas, our intention would be to put together a study group that would have broad representation, including the Oregon University system and, as identified in the bill, Oregon State Hospital, and in addition, our partners in community corrections.
All right. So who's going to do the research?
Chair Menas, the group will do the research. Probably the bulk of the work will fall to me and my staff.
Okay, are you a PhD clinical psychologist?
I am a licensed clinical psychologist, yes.
Okay. Assuming Senator Courtney.
Okay, so this fascinates me. The sex offender treatment unit at the Oregon State Hospital is shut down. Is that right? Nobody's in it?
Chair Menas, Senator Courtney, yes, that's correct.
How long has that been shut down?
Approximately 6 years.
Is that? I'm curious to know why you're doing this in connection with the Oregon State Hospital.
Senator Courtney, that was a request made by Representative Devlin, who initiated this bill. In addition, there is an expertise base that resides still at Oregon State Hospital. They have some staff who are expert in this area.
And who are they providing the treatment to at the Oregon State Hospital?
Currently, I don't believe they're providing any sex offender treatment. Nevertheless, they have people on staff who are well experienced in this area.
Let me just understand this. So we have 3,000 inmates of the 10,000 inmates within the Department of Corrections today are in there for a sex offense. That's their primary sentence, as I understand it.
That is correct, approximately.
And so one day they come out, and many of them come out under a sex offender treatment program. At least those kinds of words are said to the public when it comes to sex offender notification types of notice and things. Right.
Yeah.
So what you're telling me is nothing was done while they were in prison, but now something's going to be done now that they're out of prison.
Chair Menas, Senator Courtney, that is correct. As of two legislative sessions ago, the department, the governor, and the legislature all agreed on that course of action.
And the best course of treatment right now in terms of the science is you just got to always know where they're at, i.e. close supervision.
Chair Menas, Senator Courtney, no. What I suggested is a combination of close community supervision with community treatment that's done in an integrated manner. That's done in most Oregon counties. Some Oregon counties, such as Jackson County, are nationally famous for the work they've done using the polygraph, parole officer, treatment agency, all working hand in hand.
Why would you conduct a study about something you already know about? Why would you just say, we agree with it, do it? I don't understand. Would you tell me why that doesn't make sense to me? I don't understand. What the hell is that missing? I'm sorry, I don't mean to be talking about it. It's something that I'm very confused.
We're trying to figure out the sequence and the rationale behind why we're doing it in this fashion.
Why do a study?
just do it or don't do it.
Chair Minnis, Senator Courtney, yes, you make a good point. We have been studying this for some time. From the House side, there was a request that we formalize this study, reexamine, and put it into a format to present as a written report to the legislature, and we are agreeing to do so.
Did you read it once?
Senator Harper.
Generally, it's been my experience that we do studies in the legislature and we don't have the guts to say no. Is this one of these things?
Chair Minnis, Senator Harper, I really don't think I'm in any position to answer that. With all due respect, sir. An argument, as Senator Courtney just made about, I guess, the Nike phrase, just do it, and, you know, go ahead and prioritize it and make it happen, is certainly a good argument. Sometimes, in my experience in state government, it takes a while to develop the momentum to get to that point.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, would you be doing this study anyhow?
Chairman, Senator Duncan, frankly, we have done a couple of studies in the last 2 years that are similar to this. I think the point of this is to combine that information and present it as a formal report to the legislature.
Would you be able to do that without a mandate from us telling you to do it?
Chair Menas, Senator Duncan, yes, certainly we could do that.
Can I just ask,
why do we micromanage?
What? You're certified smart in this, right? You know what you're doing in this sex offender treatment stuff, right?
Senator Courtney, certainly leading.
I mean, I don't know if I agree with whether you could. I know you can't cure them, and I have mixed emotions about it. But anyway, I know you got to pay attention to them when they're out, because that's important.
Right.
But what are you going to come up with, a brand-new theory that the scientists at Johns Hopkins haven't even thought of or something? I just don't. There's something I'm missing here. Are you going to decide? The real issue here is, no, we're going to decide whether we're going to do it at Oregon State Hospital or we're going to go out and do it in Ontario versus Oregon State Hospital. Is that what's really involved with this bill? Is that what it is? It's sort of a backdoor way of citing something like this at Baker City, where they have just sex offenders, I believe, or Ontario versus... There's got to be something here that's good, or it's supposed to be good, but I can't figure it out.
Chairman and Senator Courtney, I think the issues have less to do with citing than they do with program models. And you could probably bring a number of certified smart people up here who would tell you somewhat different things. Some people would say to you that a residential hospital-based treatment is the best, and others that a pre-release program is the best. This is a way of sorting through that and coming up with a unified position is one way of looking at it.
Do whatever you want, Mr. Chair.
Dead bill. Next thing. Thank you very much, sir. Let me see. 3049.
Okay. Is anyone here for this bill, 3049?
3049.
Russ Spencer or any of his crew?
Going twice. 3049, whose bill is this?
Okay.
I'm looking at this one.
All right, 3049.
Dead bill.
Hey. I tell you, buddy, this is not, we don't need to close this committee because.
It's closing itself.
Well. I'll tell you one thing, we don't screw around too much.
Boy, if I was sitting out there and I had a bill, I'd be worried.
Work session 2355.
23.
What?
2355. That's the way to get the grasshoppers off of that. All righty.
Which one are we doing now?
2355. Chair has a few amendments, citizen. Full amendments to fix a minor problem.
Mm-hmm. You're in work session?
We are in work session.
Okay. I move the dash three amendments, Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan moves the adoption of the dash three amendments. Any discussion?
2355.
Any objection?
No.
No objection?
A3.
A3 of that.
I move.
Done.
Senator Duncan. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2355A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Duncan moves House Bill 2355 as amended by this committee to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections?
Chair will carry the bill.
Unless, of course, somebody else wants to carry it, they're more than likely to get stuck with it. All righty then. We're going to be in, let's see, short recess while we get some additional materials from LC. So, 3-minute recess.
Jane, are you ready?
We have the A7 amendment to the bill. This is my amendment. And the history of this, or basically what Section 93 will do, says that if an employer requires an applicant or employee to have an academic degree from a post-secondary institution to qualify for a position that does not require a degree with a specific title, i.e. engineering or some other business degree or whatever else is specified as a requirement for the job, then it would be an unlawful employment practice for the employer to refuse to hire or promote or in any manner discriminate or retaliate against the applicant or employee only because the applicant or employee meets the educational requirement for the position by having a degree or title in theology or religious occupations from a school described in ORS 348594 sub 2 sub D. Now, that particular statute is the section within the Department of Education's statutory section that it sets up a place whereby the Department of Education will review educational programming within schools of theology. If they meet the Department of Education's requirements for sufficiency in those areas, then they will grant that school the ability to grant a baccalaureate degree or an associate's degree and not merely a diploma. Now, the reason that this is in front of us is because there is at least one college in the state of Oregon that is a substantial college, has been in business as a college for over 30 years. That college is governed by a church body, a large church body. The Northwest Accrediting Institution has told that organization that but for the fact that you are governed by a church and not a separate board, we will not accredit you. And this was a discussion we had in 1997, and my bill that I introduced that created this particular statute so that they could, in fact, grant degrees. Now, this is here because some employers in the state of Oregon, like the Portland Police Bureau, have in the past required a four-year baccalaureate degree from an accredited institution. So what this is saying is that where you just simply say we want an employee or a future employee to have a baccalaureate degree in general, that you cannot discriminate against one that comes from a school of theology that is granted the power to grant a degree under this statute. Now, Senator Duncan, formerly the superintendent of public instruction, asked me the questions of whether or not this is just a diploma mill kind of environment or is this granted carte blanche. It is not. It's one that's reviewed substantially by the Department of Education for sufficiency within their classes to ensure that it is not a diploma mill. The second section deals with issues where certain employers in the state of Oregon might have a tuition match program or something of that nature, which is an educational incentive program within their businesses. This is to say that if that business has an educational match program or incentive program that does not require a specific degree, i.e. engineering. So you could use Intel as an example. If Intel wanted in their advanced education program someone to pursue a degree in electrical engineering, this would not apply. But if they had a general degree requirement that did not specify a specific topic, then it would apply and would say that they could not discriminate against employees who were attending a school of the same nature as I described before. This does not apply to public bodies. The reason that does is because of the constitutional the question that we had on the floor of the Senate the other day with respect to the Establishment Clause and the Ten Commandment Bill, so that public employers are not forced to provide public revenue resources so that a person could attend a school of theology, so we don't violate the Establishment Clause issue. This is an amendment to Chapter 659, and it's employment discrimination related, and that's why it's here. Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, and I haven't studied it that much, but I'm just curious. So you're using the term degree and diploma, and I'm just curious what you're...
The difference is that anyone can grant a diploma. Only those authorized by state statute can grant a degree.
All right.
And there is a difference in terms of the validity of or the value of that particular education. And that's why the Department of Education pretty much values how they review and evaluate the
class. Okay, there, because you get a degree and they hand you a diploma.
Exactly, but if somebody grants you, like a technical school that has never been reviewed, grants you a diploma, mm-hmm. they're free to do that, just carte blanche, without any evaluation whatsoever.
Right, but kindergartens often
exactly.
give you a diploma.
But if the granting of a degree, an actual degree, is regulated by the Department of Education, and that's why mm-hmm. that's there. And Mr. Young was the person that I dealt with in 1997, who was very stringent and very, very interesting man to deal with in terms of getting that sufficiency question asked and answered. So, Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You said what prompted this was Portland Police Bureau policy for...
I just used that as an example, that some employers ask for a general baccalaureate degree, no specific area of study.
I thought the Police Bureau had just lowered their requirements.
They did, and that's why I said they did in the past, okay. But there are some agencies like the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department that do still require a four-year baccalaureate degree, but not in a specific area. It doesn't have to be in administration of justice or law or anything of that nature. It can be in literally basket weaving if such a degree was offered. So that's why this is here.
We have a short recess.
Yes, short recess.
Chair, I move the -A7 amendments to House Bill 2352.
All right. Senator Metzger moves the adoption of the A7 amendments to House Bill 2352. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered.
Chair, I move House Bill 2352 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Metzger moves House Bill 2352 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered.
And I will carry the bill.
Unless somebody else has a strong desire to carry Chapter 659 on the floor of the Senate. Yes, do we have a phone call? Yeah, are you going to dial it? Oh. Waiting for the phone number that we're going to call.
Yeah.
You know, which bill is it? 2387. Yeah. Let's just look at 2387. Let's do a public hearing.
Oh, yes.
A work session.
Work session.
Okay, work session then.
Work session.
Okay, Marilyn, tell me why we care about this. Session. This bill is Representative Butler's bill that the committee will recall deals with the allocation of resources that are derived from the criminal fines and assessment accounts that come in from collections via the counties.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 890.
Ways and Means.
Which is a dash two amendment, right?
No, just the original bill.
Okay, I move Senate Bill 899 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Duncan moves Senate Bill 899 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion? And just for the committee's understanding, this particular bill has kind of been tied up in some dialogue and discussion that's been going on with House Bill 2877, which is over in Max Williams' committee, which is a bill that restructures the allocation of criminal fines and assessment monies, which is also tied into the debt service for the police academy that we've been talking about, which is tied into the allocation of the siting of land in South Salem, which is tied into so.
Do you expect Ways and Means to follow?
I'm helping them.
Does this deal with the kicker in any way?
No, it's not dealing with the kicker. Any further discussion? Any objections? Well, we're waiting. The file isn't here, apparently, in the room. What are you here for? I forget the bill.
1439.
It's a very simple bill.
All right. Public hearing on 2614. Why don't you come up and tell us about it? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Stern. I'm the Amhill County Clerk, and I chair the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee. House Bill 2614 was introduced at the request of our association to look at some current issues surrounding the appointment and the hiring of appraisers for the property tax, the Board of Property Tax Appeals, and the appointment of who the legal advisor to the Board of Property Tax Appeals. In many counties today, appraisers are not used as they once were, but current law still requires that we must contract or hire them or make some arrangements for them. This opens up the door for us to, if the board finds they have no need for an appraiser, that they will not enter into that contract relationship. In the case of the legal advisor to the board, most counties now have county councils that are doing the work, but the current law requires that the district attorney do that. We have an amendment B.J. Smith from Clackamas County can talk to that is also being proposed that we're certainly in agreement with. But the idea is to try to some of what we're doing currently in various ways just to streamline that and put it in statute. I'd be happy to answer any questions relating to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm B.J. Smith. I am the Government Relations Director for Clackamas County. And we would request that the committee add to the bill the Dash 1 amendments. And the Dash 1 amendments do only really one thing. They broaden the choice of attorneys available to the clerk for the purposes of representing the Board of Tax Appeals. In many counties, the county council's office is the attorney of record for the assessor's office. And we think that the assessor, of course, is often a party to proceedings before the Board of Tax Appeals. This would just simply allow for any county council to avoid any potential conflict of interest by allowing the clerk to appoint outside counsel. Thank you.
All righty. Anybody excited about this?
Yep.
Really?
Okay.
We have work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2614.
All right. Senator Duncan moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2614. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2614 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2614 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Thanks. Senator Duncan gets carried.
Okay, I get to carry it. Okay.
And you're on one more bill here. This is a public hearing on House Bill 3915. Charles Stern.
Mr. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Charles Stern, Yamhill County Clerk, and I chair Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee. 3915 is a kind of a cleanup modernization bill. There's many places throughout the statutes that had referred to clerks keeping things in books or dockets, and in today's world, we either have it on film or in a digital format. What this does is it looks at it from a clerk's record rather than a particular medium for that record, so that those clerks who still use books could continue to do so. Legislative Council also did some kind of conforming language to address that concept. That's kind of the simple thrust of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, any questions? Work session
39. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3915 be sent before the due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 3915 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
I'd love to carry it because I'd like to clean up our cake.
Once again, carry this huge bill.
All righty.
Let's see.
You get all the archaic bills.
Yeah. I'll deal with the archaic stuff.
Are we ready with the phone call?
We're ready with the phone call.
All righty. Public hearing 2387. Work session? Work session 2387. And we'll invite the testimony of whomever this guy is.
Mark Lewin.
Mark Lewis?
Just like Martin. Our committee lifeline.
Yeah.
Mark, shall we pass House Bill 2387?
You know, that's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
The committee's
here.
Do you
have audience participation? That could be our next one. Yeah.
Hold the audience. Let's go half and half first.
Regis Philbin.
Oh, this is exciting.
Senate Judiciary.
Sound.
Hi, this is Senator John Menas calling. This is Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? No, it's not. You do. Okay. Well, a gentleman in your office wants to speak to us about a bill that's apparently important to him. House. I think that's it. House Bill 2387.
Yes. And you only get 30 seconds on this deal, right?
This must be part of the NTOP, Nelson Technology Opportunity, showing how we're really moving into the high-tech world here with phones and speakers.
Hey, Representative Patrick is here.
Not a majority leader like that.
I don't need to do that. I won't do that.
Yeah, this never happened on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Like, no, somehow they're always right there. Do you know this?
Yeah.
Beep, beep, beep. Hurry up, Martin. It might be a dead bill.
Where is this guy?
He is in some far eastern town.
Oh.
Boring Oregon.
Let's see. Where is he from? He's from Baker City.
Baker City.
All the way from Baker City. Maybe we lost him.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Martin. This is Senator Menas.
Yeah.
You're here to tell us all about House Bill 2387, why it's a good thing.
I am, huh?
Yes, sir. You're online. Everybody's listening to you, so go for it.
Okay. Do you need any background or anything?
That would help, yes.
Okay. I'm an attorney. I've been licensed since 1975. I specialize, or most of my time is involved in real estate planning, land use matters. And I've been involved in numerous partition actions. And this bill deals with an amendment to 105.10. There was a case, the Opie case, tried by two very dear friends. It went to the appeals court. The way the statute is presently written, only the person who opposes a partition.
No. He was taking in touch his technology deal.
And the case law profession in the South says And it basically goes like this, that if someone sues for partition, what will first be is when they have to use the partition. And assume that it can without running straight up to the president. Then we look at if one party can perhaps buy out the other one. And then order a sale as the third step. And we have specifically written it says only the opposing party may buy it out. So let's assume that you and I own a piece of land together. But and you're basically a ne'er do well or whatever, and I know you can't buy me out, but you're causing me great misery. I sue for partition, which says, presently written, I can't buy you out. If I sue, all we want to do is change it so that the court can say, look, either party can buy it out, depending on the equity. Land is integral to my business, and not to yours. You have to inherit your interest in it, and you live in New York City. I should probably have the right to buy you out because it's part of an integral part of my business. If you do this amendment, that will allow that, and of course the court will hear testimony on it, on all these things, and then can fashion the appropriate decree. And that's the only thing we're trying to do with this bill.
That's a good bill.
All right. Any questions by members of the Senate Judiciary Committee? All right. Counsel, why don't you tell them about the amendment?
When we had this bill for hearing on May 9th, we adopted the A2 amendment that was presented by the City of Portland and Multnomah County. And that would add into the bill that a court may not order the discharge of an interest of a public body in real property without the consent of the governing body of the public body. And that was the concern that in this partition action that something could be happen adverse to an interest of a public body, and that that not happen without their consent.
Okay, so I what you're talking about, there's a court divides a piece of land, perhaps, and says, okay, the LID only goes with this piece and not with the other one. That's what you're talking about.
That's my assumption, that that would be the kind of situation that would be anticipated.
Okay, and I don't have a problem with that. I mean, obviously, real problem with that is the first thing that comes up. And if the court physically partitions it, then you've got the problem of, well, how much is the property tax supposed to start to pay and how much is it supposed to be? Because there may be a compensation gap. But if there's a sale, there's no problem. Or if one party buys the other amount, the lien goes to the entire fee. So I don't have a problem with that.
All righty then.
So I wasn't aware of that amendment either.
Well, we're full of surprises here in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions for this gentleman? All right, Senator Beyer, you okay? Okay. We're in work session. Anybody want to move the bill? Nobody wants to move the bill?
Sure, I'll move the bill.
Senator Metzger.
I move House Bill 2387 as amended to the floor if it do pass.
All right. Senator Metzger moves House Bill 2387 as amended previously by this committee to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendations. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
There's a mail answer. I have in my notes that I was a no on the dash 2 amendment to that.
Was Senator Beyer a no on the dash 2 amendment?
He was. I do remember he did oppose the amendment.
I just write that down.
Senator Metzger indicates that he was.
Yes, and your comment was, if it's good for the private citizens, it's good for the public, I recall.
You didn't like the dash 2 amendment.
You've got a good memory.
I do.
All right.
Okay, but and the dash 2 amendments are in the
they
bill.
They are in the bill, yes.
So that'll permit me to know then.
All righty then. Any further dissent? Okay, show Senator Beyer dissenting, and Senator Courtney is excused. No other opposition.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Lewenberger.
Okay, so let's go on to the floor.
Go on to the floor.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Who wants to carry this puppy? Going once, going twice, going three times. Appears to me the chair is going to carry the bill. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
Is the phone hung up?
Yes.
2361. Anybody here on 2361?
Terry Elliott. Thank you, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. Richard Patridge is here. Yeah, wait.
Tell him,
Richard Patridge, wait just 1 minute. 2361. Anybody here on the bill? 2361. We're going to. Work session.
That was the one that I found the road with kids.
Oh, okay. Why don't you tell us about this real quick?
Let me find the file on this one.
Let you find the file.
2361.
This is one I think that you guys heard while I was not in the room.
I don't have them all.
Deals with Oregon roses.
That didn't read the last one.
Says allows appeal of stipulated judgment in certain circumstances if the party has reserved the right to appeal the trial court's ruling. Background: Oregon Supreme Court has interpreted Oregon law from barring appeals from stipulated judgments, RADA versus Oregon Roses Inc., even when it is clear from the record that the parties intended that an appeal would be taken from an interlocutory ruling underlying the judgment. Counsel, tell us what all of that mystical language means.
In the Rauta case, the parties had stipulated to the amount to a judgment in the case. They agreed to an amount of damages, and because there was really no issue, if the plaintiff prevailed, what the damages were. But what they wanted to do was to get the legal issue about whether there was liability decided by the court, because there was no issue of fact. It was only an issue of law. So this was a mechanism that saved them probably $10,000, perhaps it would be more in a more complicated case, of actually trying the case at the trial level, so they could then go up to the Court of Appeals. This would is really merely a mechanism to where the parties don't have other disagreements to get a legal issue before the court and a decision on that.
All right.
Where
so
they know they're going to appeal no matter which way the court
right,
goes.
So the parties are just trying to figure out what in the world the courts are going to say about a particular issue of law. So they stipulate something and then they appeal it, correct?
That's correct. Case,
then says X, Y, Z. And this will allow that to happen, correct? Correct, El Mundo?
Yes, that's correct.
All righty. We're in work session. Any objection? No? Anybody want to move the bill? Where's Courtney when I need it?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2361 to the floor if you do pass.
All right. Senator Metzger moves House Bill 2361 to the floor of the Senate. We do pass recommendation based on, of course, observations. I remember being told there's an amendment. Hang on.
Okay. This was an amendment. There was a dash one amendment. This was presented by Keith Garza on behalf of the bar. And it was to make it clear that there needs to be a justiciable controversy. That means that it's not, it doesn't allow seeking an advisory opinion to the court. It has to be a controversy.
I didn't think
the
court did advisory.
Well, they don't.
You had to have already. I thought that was an issue of law.
Well, that's generally true, but there was concern, I think, from the court standpoint and the bar standpoint that under the language as this bill is written, it might open the door for an advisory opinion.
Really? Anybody from the bar here? Anybody from the bar? Nobody from the bar. Okay. Motion's on the table to move to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Senator Burdick.
Well, I mean, they're not here. The bar's not here. My understanding is this is an issue. The court doesn't just routinely wander into a decision, you know, without some kind of an issue of law anyway. I thought that was a legal principle, but I'm not a lawyer.
I just would note that the person who presented this is the chief clerk for the Supreme Court. Or excuse me, it says lead appellate staff attorney to the Oregon Supreme Court.
All right.
Want me to withdraw my motion, Mr. Chair?
Well, if it would make everybody happy, but
Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion.
Show up.
I withdraw my motion.
Senator Metzger withdraws his motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2361.
Senator Metzger moves the adoption of the dash one amendment to House Bill 2361. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2361 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
All right. Senator Metzger then moves House Bill 2361 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, and the bar owes us one, or the court, whomever. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. All right. Senator Burdick is going to carry this one. Okie dokie. Now, I want to take, we're going to wait on 920 because we've got some clarification, clarifying amendments, and we've got Representative Patridge here, who is an attorney, so we can grill him unmercifully. Public hearing in House Bill 2600. Phony, you're up, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Rob Patridge. I'd like to just show you a real short video clip, and I think this will explain the bill better than me starting off doing.
Okie doke.
What's the bill number?
2600.
You're so high tech around the house.
Yeah, it's already done.
Do we have a second for this one?
Thank you.
Bigfoot in Title Falls?
It's just free enterprise.
Are you for this or against it?
This came to my attention as a result of some of the news reports. Consequently, we've done some additional research. Attached is what we're passing out to you is just some examples of what my staff pulled off in a matter of 10 to 15 minutes on the internet, of the types of devices that are available, the types of products that people are using, and the industry that is built up around falsifying drug tests and falsifying drug testing equipment. This bill is intended to ensure organ safety and to provide some deterrence to that. While it may be funny, like the news report says, you know, when somebody gets hurt as a result of falsifying drug tests, it's damaging to us as a society. This is a problem, and that's why we brought House Bill 2600 to address that. Representative Walker asked that the Dash 1 amendments, which I gave to Mr. Prince, which I believe you have, she would prefer that these be inserted into the bill. It just moves it from a Class B to a Class C misdemeanor. I'm not opposed to that. I don't think it's necessary, but I told her that I would present that to the Senate committee. It passed the House with substantial...
Which amendment is it?
Representative Walker's.
Which Walker? V. Walker.
V. Walker.
Can we make it like a C felony?
Changes from a B to a C misdemeanor. But, Mr. Chair, I'd just be open to questions if there's any about this.
Yeah. Representative Petridge, are you aware of this kit, this Think Scan being pulled in Oregon yet? Is there evidence that it's reached here?
We haven't been able to identify where this has been used, but we certainly, because of the industry that's grown up around it, we want to prevent it from being sold at the local head shops and other things in Oregon. We don't think it's a good thing, and this is a preventative measure.
And then, Mr. Chair, one more question.
Sure.
Based on the amendment that you brought on behalf of your colleague, since you are a prosecutor, could you just tell us briefly what would be the difference between, this is for, by the way, the person who takes the test, not the manufacturer, I see you maintain that penalty. What would be the difference between Class B and Class C?
Well, Representative Walker's concern, I was a prosecutor for 3 years, I think, which most of this panel knows. Representative Walker's concern was that a Class B misdemeanor is punishable by up to 6 months in jail. In reality, we know that that never occurs. On most of these cases, on a first-time offense, they'd probably get a deferred sentence, conditional discharge kind of item on their record. So I wasn't, as a prosecutor, concerned about it, but Representative Walker was concerned about what the maximum penalty was. That was the reason.
What's Class C then? 30 days.
30 days.
That would be there. Okay. Thank you. All righty. Senator, excuse me, Bertie.
Thank you. There's no provision in here that makes any kind of assumption that if you show up and go to the create and then or whatever it is, and if they find out that you're in, that there's no connection that I can see here that you have the equipment. You know, if you turn something in, how can they tell that you've used a device? Like, one of the things that is in this packet is a tablet that you put in to purify things out. How would a prosecutor make that connection?
The prosecutor would make that connection, Mr. Chair, Representative Burke, the prosecutor would make that connection. Basically, you'd have to catch somebody in the act, or you'd have to catch them utilizing the item. The purpose of this bill is to provide the deterrence so people don't go out and buy these things and use these to do that. I think it would be rare to catch someone, but when you know, there's a lot of things in society that we put as criminal penalties because we don't want people to do, and I view this as a deterrence measure to do that, but I think it would be almost impossible to prove unless you caught the person red-handed with it, or, you know, there was some red dye or some weird thing that could never pass through your system in it. I work for a company we come in and take over facilities for other people. You know, we found a drug test that had that they had substituted animal urine, you know, which comes back clearly as animal urine, it just can't come out of a human body. Then something like that might fall under here, but otherwise it would be pretty difficult to prove.
If you don't have it, I don't see in here that just possessing this equipment would be criminalized. And since we apparently don't have a provision in Oregon law where people can watch the urine sample being done, I just don't know how you could credibly enforce it. And I do understand about the deterrent, but if everybody knows that there's no way to crack down on it, I'm just wondering how much of a deterrent it would be.
The language is twofold. One, the sale, it makes it a crime, but two, in section two, line number seven, it's the possession with the intent to use. So, you know, if your person is reaches in their back, says, "Oh, I got to go take a random drug test," and reaches in their backpack, and you see them grab one of these devices out of there, then that's how you catch. That's how you would catch someone. So,
Representative, I have a quick question here. This only applies to someone falsifying records about themselves.
Correct.
Not about someone else. So, if you had somebody in a lab who was doing this. Did it with intentionally, they wouldn't be covered, would they?
That is correct. They would probably lose their certification as a lab and do some other things that their employer probably wouldn't like.
Senator Metzger. Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, what about the circumstance, and I've known, well, at least two parents who, as part of their deal with their children, they require them to take samples before, for various home rules because of their past violations of things. And so it's a family deal where they make them take a drug test. If a child falsifies a drug test for dad, would they still be subject to this? Because I see it doesn't have anything to do with employment or other things. I mean, I guess dad would have to turn his son in and it says that, you know, he used a false thing and gave me a false report. But could they be caught under that, where it says, "Oh, I got you, and now you violated a crime because I told you you had to do this, and you gave me a phony sample"?
Well, the chair could probably tell you how these family situations are dealt with, probably more so than I.
That's
in terms
good
of
evidence to me.
So, you know, certainly, I mean, if you can prove it, you can prosecute it. It's just a matter of, you know, we give officers discretion, and we give prosecutors discretion to deal with issues.
And, you know, kind of on that point, I've actually had some cases where parents will call, and, you know, they're at their wit's end about a kid who's got some problems, and they say, "I don't want to do this, but I need to tell you about this because I think the kid needs to have some attention." And they will actually be a witness against their own children. That does happen. Not usually in a C misdemeanor or B misdemeanor scenario, but it does.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I wanted to answer from as best I could from my experience in having to monitor people taking drug tests. I always thought it was creatine, but the creatine, I don't know how she pronounced it. That can be just diluted strictly from drinking a lot of water. It's my recollection. Ms. Swenson probably remembers that too. So I don't see how you could base a dilute urine sample and then say that, you know, that was a falsification. The way this is, it could just be from drinking a lot of water.
All right.
I'll pass it down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Work session 2600.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan.
I'll move the dash one amendment. I tell you, I'm doing it with such confidence because I know that the good representative is a graduate of Willamette. 2 degrees from there, he knows his stuff, so I'm going to go with it. So I'm going to move the dash one amendment.
Duncan moves the adoption of the dash one amendment to House Bill 2600. Discussion, objections, Chair objects, Senator Harper objects, Senator Metzger objects, any other objections?
I'm sorry.
Motion fails 3-3.
Do you want the bill?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You threw me. Okay, I move House Bill 2600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2600 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Bingo, bango, bongo. It's gone. Thank you. Who wants to do the urine bill on the floor here?
Senator Harper does.
Senator Harper wants to. Okay. I spared you that, Senator Duncan.
I would have to do it, but this does something.
All righty. All righty, work session.
Should have fun with this.
2918?
Yeah.
House Bill 2918, work session. We have amendments to this bill, which the council will explain to us. Actually, we're going to do just about a 3-minute break. We'll be right back.
Yeah, we've been working.
amendments, please?
Mr. Chair, first of all, the House Bill 2019, the A and Gross Bill, you'll recall, deals with including electronic communications in the stalking statute. And then before you have the A6 amendment to House Bill 2019. And I can go through this. Section 3 of the bill adds the language with the intent to deceive or to defraud to the identity theft statute. This was done because to make it clear to judges, prosecutors, and defense attorneys that there need not be a deception with the use of identity theft. There need not be a purpose to get pecuniary gain or financial gain, but any deception is enough to satisfy the intent on that law.
Could I make a, Mr. Chair?
There,
I don't know if any of you happened to catch on, I don't know what channel it was last night, but they were talking about this, your identity theft, and a physician, someone had, all of a sudden they went to the post office and gave an address change. She didn't know about it, and all of a sudden her address started going to a drop-off in Massachusetts, and her whole identity, she's been years trying to get it straightened out, and it's really been a really mess.
I think we can thank Senator Meyer for the identity theft statute to begin with.
Yeah, my gosh, it was really scary last night when I realized what all they were doing with it.
Section 4.
Mr. Chair, Section 4 to continue, it amends the way that the state may appeal a case. This is in response or is a proposed fix to the problem posed by the Harbritz case, you might recall, from Clackamas County.
This is the, the judge that let the convicted aggravated murderer go because the trial supposedly wasn't conducted in a speedy manner. So this particular individual who murdered a child and was in death row is now out.
And Mr. Chairman and members, if you look on page 3, lines 25 through 29, that's really the crux of this, that in a felony case in which the trial court has made a suppression of evidence or made an order after a guilty finding dismissing or setting aside the instrument, the state can appeal directly to the Supreme Court. The idea is that, and you'll see on the next page, on page 4, that the court should issue an opinion within one calendar year. The idea is that we can have speedy trials, that that time is calculated against the state, and so that we can get these cases resolved more quickly. Section 5 is a technical fix in line with the what I would call the Harbritz fix. And also on page 11, if you look at page 11, line 15, this is a technical change. The Oregon State Police have a criminal lab, but they now employ non-criminalists, so they are now called analysts, so that those people who are employed are sufficient to do lab reports. Section 6 is also a technical fix regarding the Harbritz case, so that cross appeals by the state can be done in like manner to Section 4. Section 7 is also is related to the Harbritz case, as in Section 8. If you turn to page 14, Section 9, this is deals with the drug ecstasy. Ecstasy is a scheduled offense, so possession of ecstasy is a felony. A few sessions ago, the legislature crafted some enhancers of penalties for the delivery or possession of what's called substantial quantities of a drug. And so this places ecstasy in that, so that if you look on page 15, line 22, if one possesses, if there's a delivery case with 5 grams or more, or 25 or more pills, tablets, or capsules of meth, or excuse me, of ecstasy, for once we're not dealing with methamphetamines, then that is a substantial quantity. What that will do is it raises it on the sentencing guidelines. For a delivery case, would raise it to a level 8 offense, which would make most cases would be presumptive prison for those. So ecstasy, it's a new area that's exploded or has increased. So there were not commercial drug offenses or substantial quantities for ecstasy before this. The changes on page 17 are also so that if you possess 4 grams or more or 20 or more pills, again, that can be a factor for the state in proving what's known as a commercial drug offense. Commercial drug offense is another thing that elevates the penalty for possession or delivery. And lastly is a substantial quantity on page 18, H, again, making ecstasy one of those that's covered by that. Section 10 on page 18 deals with criminal citations. Criminal citations, if you look on line 7 of page 19, so that when an officer signs a uniform traffic citation, that after the district attorney has reviewed that and stamped it as reviewed, that may stand as the complaint in the case, and the district attorney need not write a new DA information. Section 11 on page 19 deals with child neglect in the first degree. Currently under statute, it's child neglect in the first degree. If a child is in, let me read this, a person having custody of a child under 16 leaves the child in a vehicle where controlled substances are currently delivered or manufactured for consideration or profit. The term for consideration or profit is removed, so if a child is in the car when controlled substances are criminally delivered or manufactured, they are subject to this, with the exception on page 20, line 5 and 6, that if the controlled substance is marijuana, because the way that is treated as being decriminalized, the state must prove that there was consideration or profit. Section 12, again, deals with the OSP laboratories, changes the name from crime detention detection laboratories to forensic laboratories, as does 13 and 14. Section 15 is a criminal mischief bill, or excuse me, part of the criminal mischief law. Criminal mischief is a property crime for destroying or damaging property. Currently, the state can what's called aggregate the amount if it is done. If you look at line 21, against multiple victims in the same course of conduct, or against the same victim within 30 days, then if you do that, the state can say, can take all those damage, you know, property damages together, and if they reach $750, can charge you as a C felony. The term in the same course of conduct has been construed very narrowly, so the change is to by similar means. So this is to look at if someone is graffitiing a large area within 30 days, the state can aggregate the damage so that they can reach the threshold of a C felony. Section 16 deals with when a peace officer writes a citation for a juvenile, simply says that the peace officer shall give a copy of that citation to the district attorney. Section 17, that when a youth is lodged in custody, that the district attorney shall receive a copy of that report. Currently, those go to the juvenile department in some counties, and the DAs do not see those. Section 18 is an update. We have, as you may recall, computer crimes. This is an update, if you look at page 22, line 29, of the definition of computer, which, frankly, some computer nerds said that this was high time that we added this language. So it's an update of that because the computer crime statute was written several years ago. And lastly, on section 19, this is regarding the 60-day rule. Currently, that sunsets, the current law sunsets in 2004. This would repeal that sunset for the 60-day rule, so the current law there wouldn't be a sunset. And section 20, there was a mistake in the definitions. These ORS 475.996 and ORS 475.999 are the areas in the drug laws And when the definitions for drug laws were updated, those two were not included in the definitions. So this is another technical fix to make it clear that the definitions for the drug laws apply to the substantial quantity issues that I mentioned earlier and the delivery of a controlled substance within 1,000 feet of a school.
All right. Thank you very much, then. If I could get a motion at some point here to adopt these final amendments.
I move that we adopt the dash A6 amendments to House Bill 2918.
The report moves the adoption A6 amendments to House Bill 2918. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Do we have on this section on the Supreme Court process from the Harvard case, have we heard from the Supreme Court about what kind of impact this will have?
What kind of impact it would have?
Yeah, and what they think about it.
We have not heard from the Supreme Court, and they're not generally in the habit of coming in and testifying on this kind of legislation. They can do it if they choose. However, my impression is this will probably save money because it bypasses the Court of Appeals, or could.
But I'm just dropping the amendment. Has this idea been out for them to be able to respond to?
Nope, has not.
And the other question I had, Mr. Chairman, is some of this stuff looks like it might have a fiscal because it enhances penalties.
Could very well.
Do we have any kind of estimate on what?
We do not. Thank you very much.
You're
Chair takes complete and total blame for these, but quite honestly, when the Harbis case came down, subsequent issues, I asked counsel to do his very, very best to come up with some legislation that might help correct that. Further discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
Chair, I move House Bill 2918 as amended to the House Senate floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves House Bill 2918 as amended at the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So order. The Chair will carry this fine piece of legislation. And with respect to the Ways and Means issue, there will be a fiscal on this, and my assumption is that there will be a fiscal by the time I get to the floor. My expectation is that some of these provisions are probably objectionable to some of the parties that might be affected by it, and so this fiscal will more likely than not be substantial. However, the Chair intends to work with the co-chairs of Ways and Means to make sure that we get accurate information. Eventually, it will be at least tracked by Ways and Means. If not going to Ways and Means, the Chairs will know specifically what it costs, and it will have to be calculated in their figures. At this point, then, we're going to be in recess until... Does anybody have other places to go? You do?
Not until 3:30.
Until 3:30? You have to go to the place. All right, Senator Harper's excused. Where do you have to go? Where do you have to go?
Do we have to come back?
We're going to be adjourned. Are we coming back this evening then, Mr. Chair?
Nope, we're adjourned.
Okay.
Good.